From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the 116th class of Congress is being sworn in today. It includes record numbers of women, including for the first time Native American and Muslim women, and a democratically controlled House of Representatives. They all hit the ground running in the middle of a government shutdown. We're joined by NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. And Kelsey, you've covered Congress for a while. Just your thoughts on this day.
Well, it's really interesting to watch a really big and robust freshman class come in. This is the largest that we have seen in many years, and it's also the most diverse. But I think it's really interesting to point out that while this freshman class is very diverse, it doesn't really change the overall aspect of the fact that Congress is really still predominantly white and male. So this is a changing Congress, but a slowly changing Congress.
Right, but it sounds as if you scan the rooms, you can see the difference.
Yeah, particularly for Democrats, they have made a strong effort to recruit more diverse candidates. So you'll notice a larger change on the Democratic side of the aisle.
Well, the House, which the Democrats now control, gets to work immediately after being sworn in. There's a short-term measure they're putting forward that would fund most of the government for another month, while a longer-term solution on border funding and homeland security can be debated. Here's incoming House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. He spoke on Morning Edition.
Those bills gives us another 4 weeks with government open, with government serving the American people, with federal employees not traumatized by thinking they're not going to get a paycheck and not be able to meet their mortgage payment or their car payment or their kids' college payment. We think that's the right thing to do for our federal employees, but more importantly, it's the right thing to do for our country and for our citizens.
But didn't President Trump already reject such a measure? So, you know, in that case, what are House Democrats doing here? I mean, you know, Republicans might say they're showboating.
Well, just to clarify, what they're doing is Democrats are introducing a package. It would include full year funding, so through the end of September, for six of the seven areas of government, and then would leave just the Department of Homeland Security and fund that for another month to give them more time to negotiate. Now, those bills, as Democrats keep saying, those six bills were negotiated by a Republican-controlled Congress, the one that just wrapped up as just a few minutes ago. And they're saying that these were Republican-approved bills. And while the president says he won't accept it, it's important, I think, from the perspective of Democrats, or so they have told me, it's important for them to put their stamp on it and say their first act in office is to say that a shutdown is not something that they will accept. And then they put the political burden on Republicans in the Senate and in the White House to make up their minds about how to respond. Yeah. So it shifts kind of Democrats really very much want to be able to claim a space of being the adults in the room about the shutdown. And they think that doing this will help that.
Well, and what happened in that meeting yesterday that we know? This was President Trump inviting the top congressional leaders to the White House to talk about this standoff. And afterwards, here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
And it was a civil discussion. And we're hopeful that somehow in the coming days and weeks, we'll be able to reach an agreement.
Weeks. I mean, paychecks will soon be stopping. Toilets and garbage cans, at closed public parks are still overflowing. What's the sense? Is there really a sense it might be weeks?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. And yeah, I mean, paychecks have already stopped for many of these people, including the contractors who would not get back pay. So we're talking about people like the janitors and security guards who are working here or who are furloughed. Now, it's really unclear to see how long this will last. The Majority Leader McConnell tends to be a very cautious guy and doesn't want to overpromise things here. But it is possible that this could last weeks because it's entirely up to what the president is willing to accept. Somebody has to back down to make a deal.
Yeah. Well, and we're thinking of the things that might happen. And for instance, the U.S. immigration system has already taken a hit. The system the government offers employers to check the immigration status of potential hires is completely unavailable. And of course, this is the issue that the president has focused on. So might things like that, as they surface, move people in different directions?
Well, it's hard to say because the president really feels that a shutdown over a border wall is appealing to his base and his core Republican voters. He thinks that this animates them, and he has said many, many times that immigration is a good issue for him. Fighting on it is a good thing for him. And he's been not at all shy about talking about a shutdown because of that. Yeah. So if those consequences may seem far away to him.
Yeah. We have 30 seconds less than that. There's been murmurs of impeachment. We're hearing from the top leaders like Rules Committee Chair Jim McGovern. No, there aren't the votes in the Senate.
Well, that's probably true. The Senate is a different issue. The House is where an impeachment would start, and that is something that will probably be debated as more information comes forward.
NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell, thank you.
Thank you.
Los Angeles has officially released an earthquake early warning app. It's called Shake Alert LA, and it's designed to warn people that a quake of 5.0 or greater magnitude is coming seconds before the shaking begins. Sandin Totten is science reporter in Los Angeles. Sandin, how does the app work?
So I just downloaded it. I have not yet gotten an alert, so I don't know exactly what it'll look like when an earthquake strikes. But the way it should work is that, you know, you have to turn the app on once, but you don't leave it on, and it'll work in the background. And when it gets sort of an indication that, you know, there's shaking happening in the distance somewhere, you'll get a little buzzing on your phone, and it'll say, you know, you've got, I don't know, 10 seconds before you should feel shaking in your area. And that'll give you enough time to kind of drop cover, get under a table, you know, make sure you're safe and you're ready for what's about to happen.
Well, let me just say I'm glad that you haven't gotten a warning yet. And we hope you don't for quite some time. But I guess the way this works is that the speed of modern day communications, like a warning that you'll get on the app, is faster than the seismic shaking that goes through rock. Is that correct?
Yeah. So what happens when you have an earthquake is that you've got two different kinds of sort of seismic waves. And the first ones are called P waves, and they're actually not that damaging. They're not really the kind we'd feel, but that would be set off first, and those would travel through the rock. And the sensors that we have all throughout the state, these little boxes that we've buried in the ground near faults, they're going to pick up that P wave shaking, and they can send an alert that goes faster than the P wave to all the phones and satellite towers and stuff like that saying, you know, hey, something's coming your way. Then the second set of waves, the S waves, they're the ones that really shake the rock, kind of like, you know, the Incredible Hulk pounding on the ground sort of thing. And those also go a little bit slower than modern communication. So you really have all this time when there could be lead time if we can get the message out where these sensors have felt something shaking, but it hasn't reached people in major cities maybe yet or far away from the fault. Now, the problem is if you're standing right on top of the fault, there's going to be virtually no time for a warning to happen. We wouldn't be able to beat those shaking waves. But if you're a good distance away, maybe 100 miles or something from the fault, you could get, you know, tens of seconds of warning. And that could really be a huge boon for anybody who needs to get prepared.
That's a good point there. I mean, how much warning would it take to really be able to prepare? If you had just a few seconds, what could you do in that time?
Well, you might not be able to do a lot. If you're hearing this right now and you're about to have an earthquake, drop, cover, get under a table or something and hold on. But what really is important here is all the things that could be automated. So Lisa, imagine an earthquake starts and all the trains in California suddenly slow down or come to a stop so they don't get thrown off the tracks. Imagine if in hospitals, surgeons get an alert and they can put down their scalpel right before they're about to do some sort of tricky incision. Elevators pause midair so that they're not going to, you know, get jostled or fall. Even utilities could shut off so power lines aren't going to break. There's a lot of automated stuff that could happen within seconds, and that's the stuff that could really be important.
And some of this is already going on in Mexico and Japan. There are early warning systems there that apparently worked very well. What are the possible faults, excuse the word, but the faults of this one?
Yeah. So yeah, Mexico and Japan have both had theirs for quite a while, decades. And one of the things that you have to worry about is that there are a lot of false alarms. That's going to be part of the game here. There could be shaking caused by construction or other things that might be able to trigger it in weird cases. There's also, you know, the just false alarms where maybe the shaking wasn't as bad as they thought, and you're going to see that there might be a quake and then you feel nothing. We may, if you have this app, get an alert and then feel nothing, but I guess it's all supposed to be worth it if we get that warning before the big one.
So this is just for Los Angeles County. Are there any plans for a similar app in other cities in California or for the whole state?
Yeah. So right now we've got several hundred sensors in California. They want to do maybe double that. I think we have about 600 in California and maybe 800 up and down the West Coast. And these sensors, you know, if we get a whole bunch more, we could really expand the system. Right now we're just piloting this app in Los Angeles. But there are plans for a statewide one to be rolled out eventually. And I think the goal, one day, USGS would love to have a whole West Coast-wide shake alert that could warn people even in Seattle or, you know, Oregon about impending quake doom.
Impending quake doom. It sounds like if you have that kind of hanging over your head that there might not be any app that can make you feel better about it, but you live in Los Angeles. To what extent do you actually feel more secure now that you downloaded it?
I'm more excited to see how the technology works. This app has a little checklist about a quake kit you can get together, you know, all the supplies you might need, the water, food rations, you know, all that stuff. I think that would make you feel a lot more secure because, you know, there's a good chance a lot of us are going to survive the big quake, but the hard part is going to be after the rebuilding and getting your life back together. So the prep you do now could really help.
By the way, when you say the big quake, the big one, what are the latest forecasts in terms of seismic activity?
Oh, well, the latest hasn't changed a lot in that we're really overdue for a major quake on the San Andreas Fault. We just know it'll do a lot of damage. We don't know when it's coming or how bad it'll be, but, you know, the science says it will happen. So it could happen right now on this phone call. So if I suddenly go dark, you know, that's what happened.
Well, there's an app for that. Sandon Totten, science reporter in Los Angeles. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
You too. Stay safe, everyone.
We've been trying to learn more about a lengthy report in the New York Times about a split in the Women's March, the nonprofit behind the huge protest in Washington after the Trump inauguration. That there is a split, everyone agrees on. There will be two major groups leading the next March day, January 19th. But why this happened? Well, that's another story. The report claims that two women of color in the leadership, Tamika Mallory and Carmen Perez, made anti-Semitic remarks to organizer Vanessa Rubel, who is Jewish, and that she was forced out. We spoke with her yesterday. She says she doesn't remember some exchanges reported in the Times, but
what I remember and what I was taken aback by was the idea that Jews were specifically involved and predominantly involved in the slave trade, and that Jews make a lot of money off of black and brown bodies. And similar things were repeated sort of throughout our organizing.
Vanessa Rubel went on to start the group March On, but reports surfaced that Tamika Mallory, now co-president of the Women's March, attended a rally with Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, a noted anti-Semite, and the questions flared up again. Tamika told the New York Times she didn't say the things attributed to her, and Linda Sarsour, another Women's March leader, wrote a post sympathizing with her. Let's bring in Tamika Mallory, co-president of the Women's March. Tamika, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. It's a very tender topic. Let's get to it. Vanessa Rubel says she was taken aback by you and Carmen Perez saying that Jews predominantly were involved in the slave trade. Did you say that?
Absolutely not. That conversation did not happen. I didn't say that at all. We've heard from the trans community when they have had issues with not feeling included in the Women's March. We've heard from black women who have had a continual sort of struggle with the Women's March. And we have continued to step up to that and to try to find ways for each community to feel included in the work that we're doing.
Well, others thought that they heard you. Eddie Harmon, who's also a white activist, she says you and Carmen Perez were berating Vanessa Rubel and saying things like, you people hold all the wealth. According to Evie Harmon, she said, oh my God, they're talking about her being Jewish, and she wished she had stood up and said, this is wrong. So, not quite
sure. Well, actually,
sure.
There are other people who were there that said that that conversation did not happen.
And why was Vanessa Rubel forced out? Why did you and Carmen Perez not want her as a leader anymore?
It's very interesting that what is asked of us all the time is, why did Carmen Perez and Tamika Mallory, the women of color, decide that the leadership of Women's March needed to be different or needed to look different? And the question really should be, why did Tamika Mallory, Carmen Perez, Bob Bland,
national co-chair of the Women's March, the white fashion designer,
and a number of other women decide this? These are women of all different backgrounds. So, you know, it is just very interesting to us that this issue is as if it was just between the women of color and a Jewish woman, rather than understanding that there are a number of women, including white women, who were a part of, who are a part of the leadership. So it's not just that the villains, if you will, have attacked the others. No, actually, that's not what happened.
Have you reached out to her?
Yeah. In fact, I mean, to speak to that, We've asked for a public discussion between us and some of the folks who have made these particular charges against us. And we've actually seen where they have said that they do not feel that they should speak to us publicly. Mm-hmm. We are ready at any time, but we'd like for it to happen in public so that there can be no more misinformation put out.
Well, so tell me this, Tamika. How did you respond when Vanessa Rubel said that because of her Jewish background, she had decided to dedicate her life to working for the marginalized?
I mean, that's wonderful. I hope that she, you know, is doing that and finds her way to, you know, be a part of the resistance. I mean, I don't know exactly what to say to that. That's great.
The reporting was that you and Carmen were offended by that, as if a Jewish person was comparing her own experience to the experience of the black oppressed person in the U.S. I mean, that was the reading. And you're saying that's not what happened at all.
No, it's not.
Look, I mean, how horrible if this whole thing has sprung out of a complete misunderstanding. But you have said to other members, and this again is Farrah Stockman's reporting in the New York Times, that you have said to white activist women that you don't trust them.
Actually, what I think I said was that I didn't trust particular individuals. I don't think I've ever said that I don't trust white women in general. Yeah. Yes, I have challenged white women to do better. You know, I have no issue talking about privilege and white privilege and what I believe about it and how it has impacted people of color. But this notion that we somehow have zeroed in on the Jewish community is false. I have not said that I don't trust white women as a group of people.
Whatever happened and was reported and then became part of what people thought happened got amplified by the fact that it was revealed, I believe by CNN, that you had attended a rally with Louis Farrakhan, the leader of the Nation of Islam, who is virulently anti-Semitic. And people were asking you to discount that. And then that led them to think that you were supporting his anti-Semitism, the fact that you wouldn't discount going to that rally.
So what I would, you know, hope is that people would look at my track record, 20 years of work that I've been doing, fighting for justice for all marginalized people, and not to hold me accountable for the words of any other individual. You know, I follow a set of principles, and those principles say that we must fight systems of oppression, that we cannot be effective as leaders or organizers fighting individuals, but rather that we must look at the systems of oppression and do the work to resist that. And that's who I am, and that's what I'm committed to, and that's what the Women's March is also committed to.
But I have to ask you one more time about Farrakhan, because as you probably know, he's fomented a lot of falsehoods about the Jewish people. It was Nation of Islam research that backed a 1991 paper that claimed that the Jews were more involved in the slave trade than they were. The Atlantic took a look at that. We'll link our listeners at herenow.org. But can you disavow, condemn Louis Farrakhan's comments about the Jewish people?
What I can say is that my 20-year track record shows that he and I do not agree on a number of issues. And I believe that anyone who wants to take him up on his issues, his words, should direct those questions and concerns directly to him.
Hmm. What are your concerns about the women's movement? Two large organizations, in effect, forcing women to choose which one they'll get behind. And as your friend Linda Sarsour, the Palestinian activist who wrote a Facebook post supporting you, said, the concern now is that this is exactly what white supremacists want. It was white supremacists who were behind the attack on the Tree of Life synagogue. It's white supremacists who gunned down black parishioners. You have more in common in that enemy than you have differences between these two groups of women.
Absolutely. And I believe that historically oppressed communities should not be fighting against one another. We ought to be working together. You know, I believe that anti-Semitism and anti-black racism and Islamophobia and all forms of hate need to be challenged.
Tamika, what would you tell women thinking, oh, no, this is the last thing we wanted was a split?
You had mentioned earlier that people are being forced to choose. And I hope that people won't feel that they're being forced to choose at all. I think that what people need to choose in this moment is to stand up for the most marginalized communities. We hope that people will look at the work that the Women's March has done. You know, we have not always done things properly because that is what growing pains are all about. But I think that our intention of being here to support the most vulnerable and to resist in a time where so many communities are feeling the pain is so important. And we hope that people will turn out in large numbers. Just do what makes you feel good in your local community.
Well, but are you worried about a negative effect of this? We already heard earlier this week that the Women's March organizers in Eureka, California, postponed their march there because there was not enough diversity. There were too many white women. The white women in that town were kind of offended because it is a white, you know, they don't have a lot of diversity in their town, and they feel as if they're doing the best that they can to march for people in marginalized communities, and yet they are too white. So are you worried about this driving divisions when it was supposed to unite women?
Well, I haven't had a direct conversation with those folks in that particular community. I would suggest that if people want to march, that they organize. Also, Washington, D.C. Will still be happening. We will be there. We will be marching on January 19th, and it will be all over the country. So I suggest that people who are looking for leadership look in the mirror and know that the leadership is within you.
Tamika Mallory, co-president of the Women's March. Tamika, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we will post Tamika's interview as well as yesterday's with Vanessa Rubel, formerly of the Women's March, now founder of March On, at hereandnow.org. We'll also post Farrah Stockman's reporting in the New York Times and the Atlantic look at claims of Jewish involvement in slavery. And we would love to hear your thoughts. We're already getting them. Is this a wound in the women's movement that's long been festering and needed treating? Many African-American women felt left out of the modern-day women's movement of the late 60s. Does any of this affect how you feel about the planned marches on January 19th? Thoughts welcome. Hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
One goal of education is to get students ready to enter the workforce. And as the job landscape sprouts new industries, some businesses are stepping in to help students prepare. Liz Schlemmer from member station WUNC reports.
New collar jobs. It's a phrase that's starting to get batted around a lot in education. New collar jobs are high paying jobs of the future, or rather, today. The jobs require specialized training, but not necessarily a 4-year degree, and include growing industries like cybersecurity. Tony Marshall runs a small cybersecurity business in Raleigh, North Carolina. He says one problem for him is a lot of young people don't know his industry exists.
If you ask a ninth grader what they want to be, 90% of them are going to tell you they want to be a football player, basketball player, rapper, a policeman or fireman.
But a lot of other jobs are out there, and a lot of employers are hiring. A study by the Brookings Institute found that STEM-related jobs take employers more than twice as long to fill as other jobs. And a recent survey by the North Carolina Department of Commerce found almost 60% of employers in STEM-related fields and manufacturing say they have trouble hiring.
There's this tsunami of problems that's coming up because our workforce isn't aligned very well with the job opportunities that are coming around.
Marshall helps fill his new jobs by offering apprenticeships to young military veterans. That's a prime example of work-based learning, essentially learning about work while at work. And many business leaders are trying to bring work-based learning to students at younger ages.
everyone is recognizing that that you have to start to grow your own workforce.
Ashley Busey is the deputy director of the North Carolina Business Committee for Education. She says it's no longer realistic to expect schools to fully train students for high-tech modern jobs.
What we're doing differently now is trying to tap the employers to initiate this momentum and saying, employer, you are responsible for opening your doors and creating these opportunities.
Such as offering guest speakers in schools, on-the-job field trips for students, career fairs, and internships. And NCBCE has built a new tool to help employers connect to classrooms. It's called the Navigator.
The Navigator is a marketplace that allows educators to access resources that employers have.
Educators can go online and pick out resources for their students, say a cybersecurity expert to come talk to their computer science class. Except, unlike other online shopping spots, everything on the Navigator is free. The business committee says it's the first of its kind. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper is getting behind the Navigator and plans to help spread the platform to other states.
It's going to make our workforce better because it allows real-life collaboration between educators and the workplace.
The Navigator launched in December. It's already open to public school pre-K through 12 educators, and NCBCE is now recruiting more employers to open their doors to students. Employers can also use it to advertise internships and programs they already offer. Employers like Tony Marshall from the cybersecurity business.
I think the Navigator could be a wonderful tool in terms of educating those young people so they can opt in. I don't know how many young people that we have that opt out of some of these jobs because they just don't see themselves in it.
And North Carolina employers have a big task if they want to grow a workforce to fill the 22,000 tech jobs that are currently vacant across the state. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Schlemmer.
North Korea's top diplomat in Italy and his wife have disappeared from the embassy in Rome and are reportedly seeking asylum in the West. This is according to South Korean intelligence officials who briefed lawmakers. The BBC's James Reynolds is in Rome. And James, what do you know about when North Korea's acting ambassador Cho Sung-gil vanished and where he might be?
Well, the reports we're getting, and I stress these reports, the first ones coming from Seoul, suggest that he was last seen at the end of November, so at least 5 weeks ago. Those reports also say that he has requested asylum. We've put that to the Italian Foreign Ministry, and Italy has replied by saying it's not aware of any asylum request from him. So at the moment, we simply cannot answer the question, where is he?
So is there any reason then to believe that something more sinister might be going on, that he could have been kidnapped or killed or any other option?
There's certainly no reports coming out from Seoul or from South Korea about that. And bear in mind, those newspapers in Seoul are, of course, extremely well connected with this kind of story. And the fact that they haven't broadcast or run any of those stories tends to suggest perhaps that's not necessarily what they're thinking. But nevertheless, it is a very interesting question. There is a 48-year-old man and his wife. He has been the acting ambassador to Italy, a pretty senior role, a role right at the heart of the West, a role in which he would have had to deal with the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, a vital link given North Korea's own unreliable food supplies. We don't know where he is.
Are we hearing anything from North Korea?
Not that we've seen here in Rome, and bear in mind that's not particularly surprising because North Korea wouldn't, I think, necessarily give any kind of commentary on what clearly for them may be a very, very embarrassing story. And therefore, the developments have been picked up and reported, first of all, by the South Korea.
An embarrassing story for what particular reason? This is certainly not the first defection, if it is a defection from North Korea.
Because essentially a country like North Korea doesn't want defections. Why, from its point of view, would anyone want to defect from a country which, of course, it sees as a pretty good country? The fact that there are defections, there was a senior defection in 2016 in the UK, is, of course, a blow to the prestige and the reputation of that particular state. And we can't yet work out what has happened, but it's very clear that he's no longer reporting for duty.
If it is discovered that this North Korean diplomat is indeed seeking asylum in Italy, is Italy risking anything if it grants it?
I think that's something that the Italians will have to deal with when it gets to them. Very clearly, they did make a protest in 2017 after Italy expelled the then ambassador in protest at a nuclear test by North Korea. So Italy has taken steps against North Korea, which is why Mr. Cho, the man who has disappeared, became the acting ambassador. Whether or not Italy wants to get more involved in asylum, whether or not Italy feels that perhaps South Korea, which is, of course, a welcoming home for many defectors, wants to take that on, is, of course, entirely unclear at the moment.
Okay, the BBC's James Reynolds in Rome. Thank you, James.
My pleasure.
To Colorado now. We've heard a lot about the economic benefits of legalized marijuana. Colorado has brought in $1.5 billion in state revenue since 2012. But the new laws are putting one job in jeopardy, their marijuana-sniffing dog. It seems sniffing dogs can't be taught to unsniff for marijuana now that it's legal. And in one case in Moffat County, Colorado, a marijuana-sniffing dog named Kilo alerted handlers to search a vehicle, but what they actually found was something else, and judges later ruled the search illegal. Let's find out why and how that's affecting other pot-sniffing dogs like Tulo, who lives in nearby Rifle, Colorado, with his handler, Police Officer Garrett Duncan. Officer Duncan, welcome.
Hi.
So Tulo knows how to sniff out and find marijuana, and by the way, he's an officer, correct?
Yes, he is.
So we understand, Officer, that this has become a problem because cases are being overturned. One that we're reading about in a dog named Kilo.
Well, the reasoning is because people do, with marijuana being legal, have a reasonable expectation of privacy for that particular odor. When we talk about dogs and the way they work, the dogs are locating an odor that they're trained to detect. The case up in Moffat County, the courts brought up the fact that, well, wait, this dog is trained in marijuana, so how do we know he didn't indicate, you know, right, some marijuana? I don't believe that they actually found any marijuana.
They actually found some drug paraphernalia with residue of meth on it, but the court ruled that if he'd been smelling for marijuana, that's now legal.
Yeah. The United States Supreme Court has ruled that when officers have probable cause to believe that there's illegal, and in this case we'll just use substances such as drugs, inside a vehicle, if we've built up probable cause, we can search that.
Well, so were the dogs considered probable cause?
Before the recent ruling in Moffat County,
right,
yes.
Right. It sounds like judges now are saying, well, wait a second, we don't know if they were really probable cause because if they were smelling marijuana, that's legal.
Yes. And then that brought into question the dogs that are currently trained on marijuana.
Yeah. How hard is this for departments to, I mean, you know, as we said, you can't just tell Tulo to switch to just methamphetamines.
You know, it makes our job a little more difficult. With the recent ruling, they're wanting dogs that are trained in marijuana before we deploy them. They want us to have more reasonable suspicion that there might be something other than marijuana there.
Right. So again, you can't just rely on Tulo. You also have to have some other reason to have gone into somebody's truck or car or whatever, something other than Tulo's nose, which is why we understand that Officer Tulo will be retiring soon?
Yes, he's 10 and a half. He's been with the department since 2010. The question that was brought up when we were deciding on how to replace Tulo was whether we wanted to train those dogs on marijuana still.
Yeah, and do you?
No, actually, we made the decision not to because it's not as practical to have a marijuana-sniffing dog on the road anymore.
Well, and those towns that seem to be replacing their marijuana-sniffing dogs are training the new dogs only on heroin or ecstasy, but not marijuana, so that, again, these dogs can be reliable reasons for them to take action. It sounds like Tulo's had a good run, but I'm sure you're going to be missing him.
I'm kind of a rarity. I actually own him. The department doesn't. So no matter what, he's coming home with me.
It is expensive to buy these and train these dogs, thousands of dollars. For some towns, I'm sure it's not that easy.
No, and actually in our scenario, it wasn't. We actually got Tulo because of me. I went out. I purchased him as a puppy. I got him trained. The department was able to pay a few dollars so that we could get certified. And now that we're looking to replace him, we don't just have an extra $10,000-$15,000. Dogs green without any real training can be $5,000-$10,000. On top, you have to add on the time for training and getting certified, and that can add on another expense that a lot of departments, such as, you know, rifle, because we don't have that kind of money. So we actually had a local 4-H kid named Carter Falk. He came to us and offered to help us start raising some funds so that we could purchase a new dog. So Carter was instrumental in helping get us two new dogs that will be certified in January to take Tulo's place.
That's terrific. Will there be some sort of retirement ceremony for Tulo?
Yeah, we're actually going to have a retirement ceremony at one of our local little theaters, the Ute Theater here in town, on January 24th.
And what will you say to Tulo about his contribution?
Tulo's contribution to our community has gone not only from, you know, locating drugs and getting drugs off the road. We do a lot of public relations stuff in the schools. Kids love him. Parents bring up their kids. We get to talk.
What's his biggest bust, his biggest case?
Drug-wise, his biggest was before marijuana was legal, 8 pounds of marijuana. The other one was a kilo of methamphetamine.
Well, Officer Garrett Duncan, we would like to salute Officer Tulo, again, soon to be retiring, and wish you well with the new pups that Carter Falk helped bring to the department. You just never know what you're going to have to deal with in law enforcement. Retiring marijuana-sniffing dogs because of the change in the laws. Who would have thunk?
Yeah.
Officer, thank you.
Thank you.
The Clemson Tigers and Alabama Crimson Tide will play in the final college football game of the season Monday night. We've seen this before. This is the third time in 4 years the teams have faced each other for the national championship. And if you'd like to go to the game, you're in luck. Ticket prices are falling fast. They're now hundreds of dollars lower than usual for a game of this caliber. Let's take a look with Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
So money in a minute. First, the game itself. In the 2015 season, Alabama beat Clemson. In 2016, Clemson knocked off Alabama. So who has the edge this season?
Yeah, and let's also mention that last year when Alabama made the championship game, but Clemson did it, it was because they beat Clemson in the semifinals. So this is a quite familiar matchup, and I would say do not bet against the Crimson Tide. Each of these teams, so as we've documented, this is a familiar rivalry. But that doesn't mean all the players have played each other. And in fact, neither of the quarterbacks have faced the other team. And in Alabama, you have the runner-up for the Heisman, Tua Tagovailoa. Tagovailoa. And he's amazing. He very well could have won the Heisman. And he's been dissecting defenses. On the other side of the ball, you have a young kid, Trevor Lawrence. I'll read from his Wikipedia page. Lawrence is regarded as the best quarterback prospect ever. And it's on Wikipedia. And, you know, someone from, I don't know, Florida State or South Carolina would have jumped on to correct it if it weren't true. So these are great quarterbacks on the field. I do think Alabama and their defense have the edge.
So you're making it sound pretty good. So why then have ticket prices for the game in Santa Clara fallen so much lower than they usually would for this kind of championship game? A face value ticket of nearly $500 is now selling in some cases for the price of a good dinner for two with drinks and dessert.
Really? I think a good dinner for two goes for $600, but I live in New York City. I would say it is just that. It is the familiarity. But also, don't discount the fact that this game is in Santa Clara in Northern California. You know, and in the past, the last time they met, they were in Florida. So Alabama, South Carolina, these are states that abut Georgia, which abuts Florida. A lot easier to get to. Maybe the casual non-diehard for either of these teams will stay home and watch the game on television or, you know, go in for that cheaper than face value couple hundred dollar ticket.
So there was some angst among college football fans leading up to this game about how uneven the semifinals were. Clemson destroyed Notre Dame 30-3. Alabama blew out Oklahoma. Is there something, and there's been a lot of talk of this, of course, over the years, is there something still wrong with how college football playoffs are structured?
We have a two-game sample size. And this is the great thing about college football is they don't – it's great for arguing. They play very few games. Then you could argue about everything. You could argue about who deserves in. You could argue about how many teams a championship round should consist of. The argument before this week was that number three and four teams, Oklahoma and Notre Dame, weren't as good as some of the other contenders, teams like Washington and Georgia. But in their bowl games, those two teams seemed awful. So then I was heard it said, oh, we don't need to expand to eight teams in a playoff, so we just need two teams. But they're retrofitting their design of the playoff, or an ideal design of the playoff, which probably has to be announced a couple years in advance, how many rounds you're going to have. They're retrofitting it to the perceived number of good teams this year. And what happens if Alabama goes out and blows out Clemson or the other way around? Do we argue we shouldn't have had a championship game at all?
By the way, do you think this game is not going to be sold out?
I think it will be sold out because, you know, for $200, you get to see Alabama play Clemson again.
So let's pivot then from college football to pro. The playoffs schedule is set. The wild card games start this weekend. What storylines are you watching for the postseason?
Well, if you want to talk about Clemson, Deshaun Watson was their quarterback a couple years ago, and he's the quarterback of the Houston Texans. And they have an interesting team. They're probably the best team in the AFC that didn't earn a bye. But they have a terrible line, and Deshaun Watson likes to run around a lot. He actually set the record for quarterback getting sacked the most times for a team that made the playoffs. So I'll be watching them. Another good team in the AFC is the San Diego Chargers. They did not earn the bye. And over in the NFC, you know, the Eagles won the Super Bowl last year with Nick Foles. This year, Carson Wentz, who is their starter, got hurt again. Nick Foles took over again, and he's in the playoffs again. They're playing the Bears. That should be, I don't know if it should be a good game. If you look on paper, the Bears are favored by the most points of any team playing this weekend, but it's Nick Foles and the Eagles. Have we not learned that there's some magic there?
Just about a minute left. Mike Pesca, I wonder if you can talk about some of the questionable decisions that coaches have made at the end of the pro season, including the decision by Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin to bench star Antonio Brown.
Yeah.
To put him off to the side because he didn't show up for practice before Sunday's game. What do you think of that?
I don't think that was questionable. I think it's very hard when you're dealing with the best player on your team. And I know Ben Roethlisberger will probably make the Hall of Fame, the quarterback, and he's very important. But Antonio Brown is the most talented player on that team. And the phrase, quit on the team, that's something sports talk radio throws out there. But he seems very upset. He wasn't showing up to practices. That could be because of injury. But then showing up late and having your agent call to say that you're not going to make game time walkthroughs, it's horrible for a large football organization. Tomlin had to do something. Would not be surprised if the Steelers cut bait with possibly the most talented wide receiver in football because of this.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. Thank you very much, Mike.
Welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It is Here and Now.